Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the life of Senator Tammy Duckworth. The outlines of her biography are familiar. Iraqi war hero who lost her legs in combat, former representative in the House, now senator from Illinois. In a new memoir titled Every Day is a Gift, Senator Duckworth fills in the rest of her story. The biracial daughter of an American father and Thai Chinese mother, she was raised in Bangkok and eventually Hawaii. Her family fled war, faced poverty, and suffered discrimination. She eventually joined the Army and became one of a handful of female helicopter pilots. But it wasn't until after recovering from her injuries that she thought her future might include a life in politics. Tell us about your beginnings. You were actually born in Bangkok, your mother Thai Chinese, your father an American. Talk about your childhood.
You know, it was a very international one. I grew up post-Vietnam in Southeast Asia, and I got to see America from a perspective that most Americans don't get. Even though I was an American, I got this perspective where America was really a shining light on the hill. You know, people respected us not because of, having won a war. In fact, we just lost the Vietnam War. And so America was still where people wanted to go. They wanted to do business with Americans. We were the ones bringing humanitarian aid. And I talk about that a lot in the book about how those early experiences following my dad as he worked for the United Nations around Southeast Asia really was the beginning of, you know, how much I love this country. I love my nation and my idea of, you know, how important it was to serve.
How were biracial children in Thailand treated?
Yeah, I do talk about that. And, you know, not well, especially, you know, at the time, biracial children were assumed to be the children of prostitutes and American servicemen. So we were not treated well. I'm sure some folks might remember, you know, thinking of the Children of the Dust, which was the name for biracial children in Vietnam. It was a little bit better in Thailand where I was growing up, but there was a lot of discrimination. It was a weird, I really explored this in the book, where it's a weird dichotomy between being scorned and looked down upon, but then also because of white standards of beauty, because I have a double eyelid and my, you know, that I was seen as more appealing and better looking. And in fact, biracial children were often the target of the sex trade and folks who would try. Like, for example, in the book, I talk about a man just randomly wanting to buy me from my mother and her, you know, clutching. And I describe in the book that she's clutching and trying to get away from him because he's trying to buy me. And she's like, because he just assumed that she was, you know, a poor Thai woman who had a biracial baby with an American GI who wasn't around. They didn't realize. No, she was married and my dad was still there. Yeah, it's pretty scary. Yeah.
So when and why did your family decide to come to the U.S.?
You know, my dad probably would have stayed in Asia as long as he could because he really loved being there. But in the book, I talk about him losing his job and not being able to find one in his 50s. And we struggled for years. And finally, we ran out of money. There was just no more money. And we moved back to the States. The biggest motivator, I think, was because of the free public school system, really, and the social safety nets. And in fact, we got back to the States and immediately went on to food stamps and public schools. Overseas, if you want to go to school, you have to pay for it. So were it not for those social safety net programs, I would never, you know, graduated high school or gone on the path to become a U.S. senator.
You write in the book, your mother did not come initially.
No, my mom couldn't come with us. I wrote about this in the book and how hard it was for me to struggle as at 15, trying to be the mom to my brother and trying to take over my mother's role. But my mom couldn't come for two reasons. One, we had no money. We only had enough money to buy 3 one-way plane tickets for my brother, my dad, and I. The other was she did not yet have a visa, even though she was the mom of American children and the wife of an American. She didn't have a visa yet. And so she had to wait. And so for a while, in Hawaii, where that was the nearest piece of American soil we could get to from Thailand that we had money to reach, we were struggling. I talk in the book a lot about what it was like. You know, I never worked harder in my life than when we were at our poorest. You know, I worked harder then than I ever did in the Army or have done since. And so today when people talk about, well, the poor, if you're poor, you just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. It's not that easy, Diane. It's really tough.
What kinds of things were you able to do to help the family stay afloat?
Well, my dad still could not find a job. People kept telling him he was overqualified, which was really code for you're too old. He was in his mid-50s. Actually, I'm 53 now, so he was about my age and could not get a job because people were saying, oh, we can get someone. We don't need someone with your level of experience. And that's all code for you're too old, for ageism. So I, at 15, became the only person in my family to have a salary. And I passed out flyers on the beach in Waikiki to tourists. I sold roses out of a bucket on the side of the road. I don't, to this day, Diane, do not get between me and a penny on the ground. I am not embarrassed. I am not ashamed. I will pick it up. I will roll over you in my wheelchair to get that penny because I know the value of a penny. I scrounged for money on the beach. Actually, in the book, I talk about how I would hustle tourists and play beach volleyball because they figured, oh, the girl, you know, I can beat the girl. And I would partner up with a local guy and we would win beach volleyball games for, you know, a couple bucks at a time. But let me tell you, I worked hard when we were poor and had nothing. You know, you do everything that you can to keep your roof over your head and food on the table.
Absolutely. You talk about one school teacher who was, in fact, helping to feed you.
Yeah, Mr. Nakamura. I hope that when people read the book, that they internalize Mr. Nakamura. And that I think a lot of people read the book, well, themselves, either they're teachers in a public school, or if they know, if they have a family member or a friend who works as a teacher, they'll recognize this story. I had a high school yearbook advisor who always seemed to us kids at our wise age of 15 and 16, he always seems befuddled. He would give us our assignment and then, you know, it never failed. He would say towards the end of the school day, oh, guys, I need you to come back. I messed up that assignment. We didn't do the layout correctly. We got to redo the layout. You guys come back after school and come back and we'll redo the layout together. And he would do that two or three times a week. And we always would just do it. And at the end of the evening, when we got it done, he would take 10 bucks out of his pocket to all four of his kids and say, here's 10 bucks. Go to Taco Bell. There's a Taco Bell right next to the school. And back then, two tacos for 99 cents. Because just get yourself some dinner on your way home. I'm so sorry I had you guys to stay after school again. It wasn't until later. I mean, we used to think, oh my God, this man is so disorganized. You know, and you're in the wisdom of being 16, looking back, I cringe. He was feeding us. We were all the food stamp kids. We were all the food stamp kids. And he knew which kids were probably not going to get dinner in that last week when the food stamps had run out at the end of the month. And he fed us. And I write pretty eloquently about how grateful I am to Mr. Nakamura and all the Mr. Nakamuras of the world out there who today are feeding kids out of their public school teacher salary.
And providing books and providing materials. I mean, teachers are having to bear the burden that the government is no longer taking responsibility for.
Agreed.
Thank heavens for the Mr. Nakamuras. I'm glad you had him. I'm interested in why you decided to become part of the military, why it even interested you.
Well, you know, I wrote this book to explain to my two daughters why I did that. Because my daughter, Abigail, is just now 6, and she is now getting to understand that mommy is different with no legs. Right. To me, she's always known me like this, but she's starting to understand I'm not like the other mommies. And she started to ask, you know, mommy, why did you do that? Why did you join the army? Couldn't somebody else have gone? Why did you go and get blown up and lose your legs? Because now you can't teach me to ride a bike, mommy. And I wrote this book. It's a love letter to my country, but it's also an explanation to my daughter why I did that. And why I did is because I love this country. I saw what America was like growing overseas, that we were the land, literally the land of the free and the home of the brave, and that America is worth fighting for. The ideals we stand for are worth fighting for. And so I wanted to serve. I thought I would do it in the Foreign Service. But my family has served going back to before the revolution on my dad's side. I was always taught to give something back to this nation. We thought it would be my brother who would serve in uniform. I thought I would go into the Foreign Service, but I joined the military. Actually, I went off to a basic training just to learn a little bit about the military in the ROTC program. And Diane, I fell in love with the Army. I was a sucker.
Interesting.
I was miserable at basic training with the drill sergeants yelling at you and everything, but I fell in love head over heels, like no one, as I say this in the book, like no one has ever fallen in love for the Army before.
I wonder why that happened.
I fell in love with the pure meritocracy of the Army. It didn't matter that I was a little half white, half Chinese girl showing up in my platoon. It only mattered whether or not I was willing to learn to shoot straight, literally shoot straight.
Were there many other women in that platoon?
In my platoon of 40-something, there were probably about 10 women. And because it was an ROTC basic training, it was mixed. So we trained together. We had the women had our own floor in the dorm, in the barracks, but we've trained together. It was joint training. So you were right next to the guys. And it only mattered whether you were if you literally shot straight, whether when somebody's, you know, was carrying the extra ammunition and that got too heavy for them, whether you stepped up and took your turn and helped carry the extra load. And that pure meritocracy was what I fell in love with. I mean, I didn't fall in love with basic training because I locked myself in the latrine and cried many times going through it.
I presume you did not experience any of the kind of harassment within the military that we hear too many women speak of today?
Well, I often, Diane, was the only woman in an all-male unit, or at least the only officer, or one of maybe two officers in a unit. And so it was on me to watch out and protect the younger women, the lower ranking women, from harassment. And oftentimes I had women come to me and say, hey, I'm having a problem. And I would be the one who would launch the EO investigation on it. I had it, but you know what? I just, because I was higher ranking and older, I was able to push back pretty hard. And so, you know, a lot of the victims of sexual assault in the military, it's not a sex crime, Diane. It's about power. Yes. It's about someone with more rank having more power over someone who's more junior to them. And so as an officer, I had enough rank that I could push back. But, you know, I experienced some of it. But I was always able to push back. And now as a United States Senator, I get to work on fixing those problems today.
How did you come to fly helicopters?
So I thought I would be a linguist because I speak several languages, having grown up in Southeast Asia. And my daddy was a signal officer. So I thought, oh, maybe I'll go into the signals, which is, you know, telecommunications. But when I was getting ready to decide what job I wanted in the military, what you have to do is you give them a list of your top choices, and then the Army picks. And at the time, the instructor said, all right, all you guys, you can choose whatever branch you want. I mean, you put down the branches you want, but you have to include combat jobs. And it didn't matter if somebody was an accounting major, for example, and wanted to be a finance officer. They still had to put down infantry, artillery, armor. And I said, well, what positions do I put down? I think I'm going to be a linguist of military intelligence signal. He goes, yeah, Duckworth, you put whatever you want. You can't put any combat arms jobs down because you're a female and women are barred from combat. And that, Diane, gave me a moment of pause because I thought, wow, I'm going to get equal pay for equal work, but I'm not going to take equal risk. So later on, I discovered that there are two branches, air defense artillery and aviation. So I made considered combat positions that you could, combat arms that you could be in as a woman. And I put those down as my number one and number two choices. And then I took the aptitude test, Diane, and I scored off the charts for it. And I talk about this in the book where I say, hey, you know, a lot of women actually self-select themselves out of jobs like helicopter pilot because they never apply and never take the test, but women make better natural pilots, actually.
Did you think that you would fly planes or did you know it would be helicopters?
I knew it would be helicopters from the very beginning, and I loved it because I love, you know, aircraft that are beasts. And that's what helicopters are. They're not sort of, you know, gliding through the air and you know, reach out your hand and touch the face of God, like the poem kind of aircraft. They're you know, heavy metal machines that defy gravity. We used to say that we would beat the air into submission is what helicopter pilots do.
But I gather that you really did not in your heart support going into Iraq.
I did not. No, I supported us going into Afghanistan to hunt down those who would dare attack our nation on 9/11. I saw Iraq as a distraction. That's, you know, it was not so much in my heart. I that's what I felt. But as a soldier, you swear an oath to defend a constitution. And the constitution says you carry out the order, you know, you carry out your commander-in-chief's orders as long as they're lawful. And George W. Bush had issued the order, which Congress had ratified, right? The Congress had voted and decided, yes, we should invade Iraq. And as a soldier, it doesn't matter what you think is right or wrong in terms of whether you should go, as long as it is a lawful order and it's not a violation of you know, the rules of war, you do your job. And so I volunteered, actually. I was very proud to go. I'm still proud of my service. And I would go tomorrow if they needed me.
Had you piloted or co-piloted a number of ventures into Iraq before that awful day when the Black Hawk you were co-piloting was hit?
Yes, Diane, I had many missions. We had been in country in Iraq for 10 months at this point. And so I had many, many missions under my belt. And we were actually towards the end of our rotation. We were getting ready to come home when I was hit on November 12th of 2004.
Tell me about that day.
It was a really good day to start off with, really, Diane. It was a bit of a rainy day. I was getting to fly with people I really love flying. Chief Warrant Officer Dan Milberg was one of my favorite pilots in command to fly with, because I always learned with him. And he has this amazing sense of humor that is very dry and very, very wry. And we got along great. And so it was a really good day. We had regular missions throughout the country. And we even had time to stop for lunch in Baghdad and in the Green Zone, which we rarely did. We normally just had to eat an MRE or I had a can of tuna fish in my helmet bag. But I got to stop and have a milkshake and a stir fry because we were in the fancy dining hall in the Green Zone. That was the last meal I was going to eat for probably 3-4 weeks. I didn't know it, but I had a good last meal. And then at the last minute, as we were done with our missions, headed back to base. This was during the second battle for Fallujah. We were diverted and picked up some passengers. And on our way back from picking up those passengers, we were hit and the RPG landed right in my lap. I write in detail in the book about it. It's pretty graphic, but it has a happy ending. But I wanted people to understand the struggle that my buddies went through to save my life and what they did. And I learned so much more writing this book about that day, because a lot of my memory is blank from the minute we landed the helicopter. Sure. Now I was awake and I did talk to people. And it's only in writing the book that I reached out and I found doctors and nurses who said, no, I talked to you. But I don't remember any of that. And so in the book, there's a pretty detailed accounting. The reason I did that was not to be gory. The reason I did that was just to show gratitude for the men and women who saved my life. And the book is called Every Day is a Gift. And every day since that day has been a gift from those people to me.
Tell me what your buddies did to save your life.
So once we landed the aircraft, my door gunner did one of the bravest things I could ever imagine. He'd been shot also, and he was bleeding out, going into shock. He took his weapon and walked towards the enemy. Instead of walking towards, we always flew with two aircraft, so the second aircraft landed immediately. And instead of running to the rescue bird, he walked towards the enemy. He couldn't run because he was pretty badly wounded and bleeding. And he stood the perimeter because the bad guys were jumping into their pickup trucks. We landed maybe 400 yards away from where they had shot at us. So we knew they were coming to us. But the one saving grace was that there was no road through the palm grove between us and them. And so they were delayed a little bit. And he stood ground And then Dan Milberg came over to pull me out and realized, oh my God, she's dead. There's no lower body. He looked at me. I was all torso and he could see my leg, which was severed, my right leg, which was severed laying on the floor of the aircraft. And the left leg was just hanging by just some skin. And so he looked at me and he's an EMT and a police officer in the civilian world when he's not serving in the National Guard. And he said, okay, she's dead. So he starts to carry me out. That's the main thing that he did, was he didn't leave me behind. He didn't want the insurgents to get my body. He didn't want the insurgents to drag me through the streets and have my folks see that on CNN. So he rescued my body. And then the crew chief from the second aircraft helped him. And they described it to me as like the scenes from Saving Private Ryan, the opening scenes. They said it was just nothing but blood and gore. And then they also carried my crew chief, who was sitting right behind me, and he almost lost his leg as well. And they got us through the second aircraft. The pilot of the second aircraft, Chief Warrant Officer Pat Minx, happened to be a medevac pilot in a previous life. So he had actually initiated medevac procedures. And so from the point of when I was wounded to when I got to the medevac aircraft was probably 20 minutes. And it was less than an hour before I was in the ER. And that's why I'm alive today.
Wow.
Because they got me to help so quickly, despite thinking that I was dead.
They could have gotten out of there very quickly, but they wanted you to be safe.
Yeah. In the book, I talk about the warrior ethos. And one of the lines of the warrior ethos is, I would never leave a fallen comrade behind. And they refused to leave me behind.
That
and because
really
of them,
is.
Yeah, because of them, every day of my life since that day has been a gift. It's literally a day that I should not even be living through because I should have died that day. And these brave men wouldn't let me die.
So where did they then get you to?
Baghdad ER. So you know the show MASH? They're called CASHs, a combat surgical hospital, CSH, as opposed to a mobile surgical hospital. So it's a CASH, a combat surgical hospital. They got me to the ER in Baghdad within 50 minutes. And that's when they worked on me. I actually, in the writing this book, was able to find the surgeon who worked on me and the nurse who put me under. And there's actually, I don't remember this, but in finding the nurse who actually cared for me and intubated me and put me under, he said that he had been reliving that day for years. I mean, it's been 15 years. He said it's one of the most searing memories he has of his time in Iraq. And you know, when you work the ER in Iraq during the battles for Fallujah, you have a lot of bad memories. But mine was one that he really remembered. And he said, before I went under, I grabbed his hospital scrubs at the neck and I said, you take care of my men. And then he knocked me out. And he said, he'll never forget that. And so for him, it was a bit of closure getting to talk to me, knowing that I made it. Because, you know, they patch you up and then they ship you out to launch through Germany and then to Walter Reed. And they never know if you actually survive.
So how much time did you then spend at Walter Reed?
I was at Walter Reed for 13 months. And I would have been there longer, but I left early to run for Congress. But I'm foreshadowing here. I spent 13 months at Walter Reed. And in the book, I talk about, you know, the recovery and what that was like. It was grueling. But I talk about some really good people that I met at Walter Reed, the Milkshake Man and Tom and L. Porter, who are Korean War veterans, who were known as the sex talk couple, and all of the great folks at Walter Reed. So, you know, the book is, it's about me, but it's really an ode to really amazing folks along the way who helped me on my journey.
More of my conversation with Tammy Duckworth, Senator of Illinois, when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Senator Tammy Duckworth about her new memoir, Every Day is a Gift. How did writing the book, experiencing what you did, change your thinking or affect your thinking about war?
I don't know that it changed my thinking about war because, you know, soldiers don't ever want to go to war, right? We're the ones who get blown up and get killed. So I'm a hawk in the sense that I would defend my country to the death. And I've proven that. And I would still defend her to the death today because America and her ideals and what we stand for in our democracy is that valuable to me. And I hope you get that reading this. But what it did, Diane, was give me a new perspective on my life. Like, it made me go through my relationship with my dad. You know, he was always my dad, but I never sort of analyzed my relationship with my dad as difficult as it was. You know, I always thought of myself as daddy's girl, but actually there was a lot of, you know, me trying to win his respect and never getting it, you know, most of my life and until the very end before he died. It also, you know, at the end of the book, I was looking at it and I thought, wow, maybe all the struggles early on is what helped me survive being shot down in Iraq. Right? Like all the, you know, having to work three jobs in high school and the struggles we went through there, maybe that just made me tough enough that I had the reserves of whatever it was I needed to survive getting blown up and learning to walk again. I don't know.
We should say that your mother eventually did get to come to the U.S.
She was there within a year after we got there, and she was a godsend, a lifesaver. I didn't have to be mom anymore. I could just focus on finishing high school. And then she started sewing and doing alterations and babysitting. And, you know, so we were all scraping for money any way that we could. And my mom is still with me. She turns 80 here in a month. And she is the toughest lady I know, let me tell you.
You write about meeting Illinois Senator Dick Durbin and the amazing role he's played in your life. Tell us about that.
So I met Dick Durbin when he called out to Walter Reed in 2005, in January of 2005, and said, are there any wounded warriors from Illinois at Walter Reed who would like to attend the State of the Union address? And Dick Durbin always invites war wounded to the State of the Union address. Every senator only gets two tickets, and he gives his up instead of bringing a donor or a lobbyist or his own family members. He gives his up to the war wounded, to troops. And that year, I happened to be one of the two at the hospital. And that's when I met Dick Durbin. And he gave me his business card and he wrote his personal phone number on there. And in the book, I describe it as me abusing that privilege very quickly.
How so?
I happened to be the highest ranking amputee at Walter Reed for about 8 months, 9 months, something like that. And we had a lot of problems at Walter Reed. The healthcare was above the best, but I don't know if you think back, there was a lot of issues with mold in some of the housing rooms, a lot of the issues administratively, because the Bush administration thought the war would be over in Iraq in 2 weeks, right? That's what Rumsfeld said. You know, they'll be meeting us with candy and flowers and we'll be done in 2 weeks. And it dragged on and on. So there were so many more war wounded showing up than they ever expected. And people like me who survived, who in any previous war, including the first Persian Gulf War, would have died with my wounds, that they were just, the system was overwhelmed. So I started calling Dick Durbin and saying, Senator Durbin, I got a guy here who hasn't been paid in 6 months. I got a guy here who his wife is here, but his mother wants to come, but the army won't let his mother come and his mother should come. It shouldn't be either or. And Dick Durbin became the unofficial ombudsman for Walter Reed. And whoever it was, he fixed the problem. Or dealt with it. And after about 9-10 months of this, Dick Durbin called me up and he looked at me and he didn't see a little biracial girl with no legs. He didn't see the wheelchair. He saw someone who needed a mission before I realized I needed a new mission because I was still trying to become a helicopter pilot again. I wanted to go back to my unit.
Did you really think you could?
I did. I really thought I could. I really thought I could. And there are helicopter pilots who are amputees back on active duty with the military, but not as severe an amputation as mine.
I see.
And Dick Durbin said, Tammy, if you think our veterans are not being treated well and we need to do better, then you need to run for Congress. And he just blew my mind. I was like, sir, you know that I have no legs and I'm in the hospital, right? He's like, no, Tammy. And if anybody knows how veterans and military men and women should be treated, it's you. You're living it. You should run for Congress.
And so you did.
I did. He gave me a new mission because I just not long after that found out that I wouldn't be able to go back to my unit. I could still serve. I served another 10 years in the Army, but I couldn't do it in an active assignment like that. And he gave me a new mission. So I ran and lost.
But that wasn't the end of it.
No. In the book, I say that I spent 3 days crying in my bathroom in the bathtub because that's the only place where my cell phone wouldn't ring. And that's true. It was devastating. But then I went to work as the director of the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs. And then Barack Obama won the presidency. And before this, you know, he was in the Senate. He'd asked me to testify before the Senate Veterans Committee. And then he called me up and said, would you come work for me and go to work for Eric Shinseki at the Department of Veterans Affairs? And I said, Mr. President, if you want me to go sweep floors because you think that's what our veterans need, I'll go sweep floors. Let's go. And then after I was at the VA, I decided to run again in 2012, and I won that race.
You brought your own infant daughter into the Senate chamber. How did people react?
Well, when I got pregnant, I knew, because the Senate was so closely divided, that I would not be able to take maternity leave. That I couldn't even go back to Illinois to have my baby. I had to have my baby in D.C. because they needed my vote. And the Senate rules say to vote, you have to be in the chamber, physically in the chamber to vote. And so I knew I couldn't take maternity leave, and I knew that I couldn't go back to Illinois. So I gave birth here in D.C. And when I got pregnant, I started working with Senator Amy Klobuchar, who was on the Rules Committee with Orrin Hatch, to change the rules so I could bring my baby onto the floor of the Senate. And there's a whole section in the book where I go into detail about the negotiations and all that, and people didn't want me to. And Orrin Hatch asked questions like, well, what's the dress code for the baby? Because there's a Senate dress code. You know, you can't wear a hat. You have to wear shoes. Gentlemen should wear a jacket. Women should have sleeves that, you know, cover your arm. And I was like, she's a baby. She wears a beanie. I'm not going to take her beanie off. And she'll be in a footy pajama. I can't put shoes on that. So she's not going to wear shoes. She will wear her hat. So that's two Senate rules she'll be breaking. Tell you what, I'll put a little baby blazer on her. But it was those types of crazy, surreal arguments. And I go into it in the book where I talk about this, and Amy Klobuchar being very, very calm and negotiating. At one point, the response was, but if we let her bring her baby on the floor, then someday there could be 10 babies on the floor. To which Amy Klobuchar goes, she says, well, that sounds delightful and lovely. Because it would mean that there were more women senators, and we want that, right? So eventually I was able to bring my daughter onto the floor. She was 10 days old when they needed my vote for the first time.
What a great story. You will be able to tell her forever.
I will. And she did wear a blazer. So, you know.
She wore a blazer. I love it. You were near the Capitol, ready to go onto the Senate floor when the insurgents stormed the Capitol on January 6th.
Yes, I was in the Capitol, but I was in the tunnels underneath. I was going from my office. I was supposed to speak at 2:50. At 2:30, I was in the tunnels, getting ready to go up onto the floor. The insurgents, the first breach occurred at 2:15, so 15 minutes earlier. As I'm in the tunnel, the Capitol police officers near me still did not have a full picture of what had happened, but they said the Capitol is shut down. You can still use the tunnels to get to the floor if you would like to move forward, but you need to go very quickly, and then you will be evacuated along with all the other senators. Now, I'm a wheelchair user, and I know that there's only one way on and off the floor, and I know how difficult it would be to move me with my wheelchair if there was not a wheelchair accessible way. So I decided to just, instead of moving forward, to go ahead and secure myself, put myself in a secure location with two staff members, and we shut and locked the doors and barricaded the doors. And I said, you guys don't worry about evacuating me. I'm fine. We can take care of ourselves. Once you get all the other senators secure, then come back and get me. So that's what we did. And we waited it out for a couple of hours. And then I was on the phone with, again, Senator Klobuchar, because she's on the Rules Committee. And I said, I'm fine, Amy. When you guys are all secure, you can come get me. And the Capitol Police came and knocked on the door and said, Amy Klobuchar sent us. So that's when I knew I could leave my hiding spot. And they sent like six police officers, some in full gear, to take me to safety.
Thinking about that, what does it say to you about the American people's view of the election?
We're obviously a very divided nation. I hope that we're less divided now with President Biden doing everything he can to reunite us as a nation. And I think we are. I think we're better off now than we were last year or even on January 6th. I think that insurrection horrified many, many people who may have not agreed with the results of the election. But the fact that Americans were using the American flag to break down the doors of the U.S. Capitol, you know, it hurt me viscerally. It hurt me in my heart to see the same red, white, and blue that I used to wear on my shoulder going into Fallujah, to see that same flag used to beat a police officer. That's my takeaway from January 6th, is the hurt and the frustration and the anger that could happen. But I think we're moving. Yeah, I think we're making our way. And listen, this whole book that I wrote, it's a love letter to my country to explain to my daughter why America is worth it. And America, Diane, she's still worth it. This democracy is still worth the struggle. It's still worth each of us showing up every day, even if we don't agree with each other. Because it's the old saying, right? It's the worst form of government, but it's the best one that I know, you know? It's the best that we can do, and we're doing better, and we keep striving for that more perfect union. And I'm going to keep showing up every day because America truly is. Our ideals are worth the struggle.
How did you feel seeing that there were so many rioters who had ties to the military?
I was pretty angry and frustrated, but I know they were targeted. I've had conversations now with Secretary Austin and Deputy Secretary Hicks about this. And the military, the DOD, is actively now dealing with this rising extremism and white supremacy within the ranks, and are working hard to counter it and to prevent it from going any further. But Diane, you should know that we've had this problem in the military before. In the early 90s at Fort Bragg, at the 82nd Airborne, there was an incident there where there was a cell of white supremacy amongst the airborne troops, and we were able to deal with it then. So we're going to work hard to fix it.
I want to ask you about some issues very much alive today. What do you see as the prospects for countering the new voting restrictions in Georgia and similar efforts in other parts of the country?
I think we need to pass a new Voting Rights Act. The House has HB 1. It'll come over to the Senate, and it won't pass as long as the filibuster is in place, because I don't know that we're going to get 10 Republicans to vote with us to get it to pass. I would hope so, but I will tell you, when we got no Republican votes for the American Rescue Plan, a bill that put $1,400 back into the pockets of people struggling to pay rent and feed their families. And, you know, that bill gave us more money for schools so kids could go back to in-person learning. They wouldn't even vote for that, you know. So we'll see. Well, we're going to have to deal with the filibuster in order to pass a new Voting Rights Act, which is what we need. I hope we don't go completely to getting rid of the filibuster right away. I hope we go to, for example, a talking filibuster. You know, most Americans, when they think of a filibuster, they think of Mr. Smith goes to Washington, you stand and speak, right? That's not how it is. It doesn't cost a senator anything to do a filibuster. You don't have to show up. You just tell them you're not going to do it. And that's not right. So if we go to a talking filibuster, it means that if you want to filibuster any bill, you actually have to stand up in the Senate and argue your position. I think that's a good first step. But I will put defending people's rights to votes ahead of, you know, the filibuster, which is a creation for the United States Senate that was really created during the Jim Crow era for Southern senators to be able to oppose, you know, a lot of the civil rights movement. We'll see where it goes.
One other thing, you're pushing hard for legislation to ensure safe drinking water. And Illinois certainly has its problems with that. How did that happen?
So we have real issues with safe drinking water across the country. And I've been working on trying to get rid of our lead service lines in this country since Flint, Michigan. I was working on Flint, Michigan when I was in the House. Illinois has by far the greatest percentage exponentially of lead service line in the nation. We have 25% more than any other state in the entire nation. 25% of it is in Illinois. Most of it is in Chicago. It's an issue of environmental injustice, Diane, and infrastructure injustice in that, you know, a lot of infrastructure is done based on zip codes, right? It's based on tax, what the municipality can afford to raise money, and then they fix it. So in the wealthier neighborhoods, they get their utilities upgraded. What has happened is, especially in the Black and brown neighborhoods in Chicago, a lot of the utilities have not been upgraded for literally decades, sometimes as far as 100 years. So there's a lot of lead service line. And what has been done is a stopgap measure, and this is done across the country. They have pumped through a coating that coats the inside of those lead service lines so that the water that flows through will not pick up the lead. But if you do what happened in Flint, which is you switch your water source, in Flint, they switched to the Flint River, which was more acidic, and it actually wore away that protective coating. So then the lead leached into the water. That can happen anywhere in the country. In fact, in Illinois, where we're finding lead right now is in Galesburg, which is a rural farming community, not Chicago. And so this is an issue across the country. In fact, I talked to some other senators from the Boston area who say that they, and Rhode Island, they say they actually have some places where they still have wooden pipes. I mean, across the nation, I think the statistic is something like as much as 75% of the water that you and I pay in our taxes and utility bills to get clean and pumped through the water, 75% of that water is wasted through leakage, and we're only getting 25%. So it makes sense to make the infrastructure investment because we're going to save a lot of money if we do.
I have one last question for you. Are you optimistic that Republicans and Democrats can work together in the Senate?
I am, Diane. I am because I just led a water bill on infrastructure water last week. In fact, we passed it unanimously out of the committee. Every Democrat and every Republican voted for it, and it passed unanimously out, and it has significant dollars in it to fix things like lead, things like sewer systems. I guess it has to be the non-sexy stuff, right? Sewage. We can agree on fixing that. But, you know, I work a lot also with, I use my connection with the military, and I go and I find a lot of Republicans who are also veterans and start from there because we have a shared background and say, okay, let's work together.
Thank you for being so generous with your time. It was wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you, Diane.
That was Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth, author of the new memoir titled Every Day is a Gift. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Sandra Baker, Rebecca Kaufman, and Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.